On a tour of pointer analysis, I told you a little bit about the applications of pointer analysis, and then we went to an example analysis, and we started looking at some of the variations, some of the different kinds of analyses you could do. So I just wanted to back up a few slides to make sure everyone's awake and remembers what we did last time. So basically, so the basic idea is we set up this pointer assignment graph, which had all these very colorful nodes. And the basic idea is we want to flow the points two sets along the flow edges in the graph. And we had this extra little issue with these store and load edges. For those, we needed to create extra edges to these yellow nodes that represented pointers that were inside heap objects. Okay, so just to remind you, this yellow L1.f node, this represents all the objects that are allocated at allocation site L1. So the field f of all those objects. And here we're saying that that field can point to an object allocated at L2. Okay, so any questions at this point? Okay, so you've got the basic idea. So then we went through one of the design decisions, which was, anyone remember? Okay, so everyone's still sleeping. That's okay, you'll wake up eventually. We talked about type filtering and how it can increase both the precision. Type filtering. Let me just find the slide first. Here we go. So the idea was we wanted to weed out objects from the points two sets that the pointer couldn't point to because of its declared type. Okay, and we saw that it not only improves precision, but also efficiency of the analysis because it has less junk to propagate around. All right, so continuing on, we want to look at some of the other design decisions that we can make in the points two analysis, and we want to see how they affect precision and efficiency. And so the next one we're going to look at is field sensitivity. Okay, and so here are basically our three options for field sensitivity. And what we've seen so far is a field sensitive analysis, so like the one on the left, I guess, your left. All right, so this is just like what we've seen so far. We create these yellow nodes to represent each field of each abstract object that could be created. But if we wanted to be lazy, if we wanted to be more efficient, we could merge some of these nodes. Okay, so have larger nodes that represent more things. So for example, we could merge the nodes for all the fields of a given object together. So if we forget that we've got field F of some object or field G of some object, we'll merge these two nodes together into a single node, and then we'll have a single points two set representing the targets of pointers in any of those fields. Okay, and so we're going to call that a field insensitive analysis. On the other hand, you could merge all the nodes for all the objects as long as they're for the same field. So you could merge these. So this node would represent all the fields F of all objects ever created, and this node would represent all the fields G of all objects ever created. Yes?
The insensitive representation safe much because usually objects just have a few fields.
Okay, so
what do these things save us? So, the first thing they save us is that we have fewer points two sets, right? Because each one of these nodes has its own points two set. So if we have fewer nodes, we have fewer points two sets. So the question is, you know, how much do we actually save by collapsing these things? So if objects have few fields, then, you know, you only save a factor of how many fields you have. So you're right that with a field insensitive analysis, you save a lot less. Now, it turns out there's another thing that we save, not in terms of space, but also in terms of time, which is that we're going to have fewer of these indirect edges that we're going to have to create if we have fewer of the yellow nodes. And that means we're going to have less iteration that we have to do, right? Because every time we create one of these edges, we end up having to redo the flow and flow the points two sets over that edge, and that might add flow to other nodes. Okay, so we'll see that a little bit more later. So any other questions here? Okay, so we're basically trading precision for efficiency. Now, here's the same code again, but now I'm doing a field-based analysis. And you'll notice that I changed the color of the node representing the field. So, you know, why did I do that? Well, so if I'm doing a field-based analysis, to figure out where this indirect edge goes, I now no longer need to care what objects P points to. Right? Before, what I did, if I wanted to add this edge, I would look in the points two set of P, I'd see that there's an L1, and add the edge there. If P had an L2, I'd add another edge to L2.f. But now if I've merged all of those yellow nodes, I know from the very beginning that this indirect node is going to go to that single yellow node. Right? So I make it a green node because now it's going to behave like a green node. I know what the flow into and out of it is at the very beginning. Okay, so basically if I have a field-based analysis, I don't need to treat loads and stores separately. So I don't need any of the red nodes. I don't need any of the yellow nodes. And I know from the very beginning what my final pointer assignment graph is going to look like. All right. So I just propagate the points two sets along the graph. Now, does this give anybody any idea about how to make this efficient? Yeah, I no longer have to worry about the graph changing on me. I just want to propagate the sets along the graph. Okay, so before what I had to do was iterate, right? Because I could be adding edges to the graph, and if I added an edge, I had extra flow. I needed to repropagate anything else that float. Here,
can you do union find? Can you do sets or something?
Okay, we're going to do union find at one point, but that's going to be different. So we're not doing union find with this. Okay, so let's say the graph was a DAG, right? No cycles. I mean, there can be cycles. In this example, we don't have any cycles. But assume we didn't have any cycles. What could you do? Start at the top and propagate things down, right? So if we do a topological sort of the graph, we can process the nodes in such an order that we only process each node only once, right? So, okay, so that works if it's a DAG. So what about if we have a cycle? You know, let's say we had a cycle here or wherever. Well, okay, so
pin through it, I strongly connect each point.
Exactly. So if we have a cycle, we know that the points to set of any node in that cycle is going to be the same. Because anything that flows into any node on the cycle is going to flow around the cycle and it's going to get to all the nodes. Okay, so if we have a cycle, we can take the cycle and collapse it into a single node or a single points to set representing all the nodes in that cycle. And if we do that to all the cycles, we get a DAG and then we can do the algorithm from before, the topological sort. All right, so with a field-based analysis, here's our algorithm. We merge all the strongly connected components, topologically sort the resulting graph, and then process each node exactly once. All right, so this is nice because each edge is processed exactly once. We get an algorithm that is worst case quadratic time, number of edges times the size of the points two sets, and it's linear in the size of the output, right, in the size of our final points two sets. So, you know, you can't really do any better than that. If that's the answer that you want, you know, just outputting that answer is going to take that much time. All right, so we gave up a little bit of precision to do a field-based analysis. And if you run this on actual benchmarks, you do see that you lose some precision, but you gain a lot of efficiency. Right, so this is a pretty good, you know, this is one of these good trade-offs along that precision efficiency curve. Yep?
Dealing with a language in which you don't have precision, would you be losing any precision here?
So if you're dealing with a language without inheritance, would you be losing any precision? It's not about inheritance.
Well, what I mean
yes.
But you could have different objects allocated at different points in the program of the same class. Okay, so if you have a language like Java where, you know, different classes tend to have different field names, and in fact, even if they, you know, even if the textual name of the field is the same, you can still distinguish the fields if they come from completely separate classes, right, that are not related by inheritance. So you can still split those up. So you still get quite a bit of precision this way. But what you can't distinguish is, you know, different uses of the same class. So, an example that comes up in Java is collections classes. Right? Or other classes that you use all over the place for different purposes. And, you know, in some parts of your program, you put certain things in your collection. Somewhere else, you put other things. And so you want to distinguish those. Once you go field-based, you can't make that distinction. Okay? But, you know, you gain a lot of efficiency. So it's up to you how much precision you need. And I'm actually quite surprised that there aren't more field-based, more people using field-based analysis. I think especially for things like building call graphs, where you tend not to need too much precision, it would be a really good way to do it. It's pretty efficient, and it would give you much better call graphs than what people usually do, which is completely imprecise. Anyway, maybe we'll see more people doing field-based call graphs soon.
So you want to do
field-sensitive and field-based?
Oh, like
do these and kind of intersect them? I'm not sure what that would do.
Yeah,
I don't know. I'd have to think about that. So maybe we can talk about that afterwards. I mean, I think you would probably lose some precision compared to a field-sensitive analysis, you know, because you're kind of reconstructing a field-sensitive one from more imprecise things, and yet you will probably wouldn't gain much in terms of efficiency because the field-insensitive analysis, that one is still pretty slow because it still has to add these edges as it goes. Okay, so, you know, if field insensitive is so bad, why do I have it here? Or if field-based is so good, you know, what's the problem with a field-based analysis? Well, okay, so field-based is great if you have a language like Java where you can be sure that if you put something into field F, the only place you can pull it out of is field F, right? You know, if you have a language like C, you can't make that guarantee. Okay, and you know, it all depends on exactly what version of C, you know, what you mean when you say C, because there's all sorts of C standards, and most programs don't follow the standards anyway. So you know, there are a lot of different things that are all called C. But anyway, so even if you're careful and you follow the standard, you still can't do a field-based analysis soundly. So for C, your options are limited to a field-sensitive or a field-insensitive analysis. And, you know, depending on the class of C programs that you're looking at, it might be very difficult to get a field-sensitive analysis to be sound. So for C, field insensitive is a fairly popular choice. Okay, so here's just an example to show that yes, we do lose precision by going field-based. Okay, so there's a program here. It's slightly different than the example we had before. But basically we have, let's see, two objects, A1 and A2, they have a field F. So, okay, so we create A1 and A2, we assign them to X and Z. Then we've got object B flowing to U, and then we assign from U to X dot F. So we look at the points two set of X, it's got A1, so we flow B into A1 dot F, but not into A2 dot F, and so then B ends up going to V, because V gets read from Y dot F, and Y points to A1. And we end up with nothing in W. But if we were to do a field-based analysis, we'd merge these two together. So when we flow the B into star dot F, it ends up going into both V and W. Okay, so now our points two set for W is bigger, so it's less precise. Okay, so here's a summary of, you know, what you get with the different choices of field sensitivity. So on the Java side, the choices between field-based and field-sensitive. Field-based is faster but less precise. Field-sensitive is slower but it gives you a lot of precision. Field-insensitive, it's slow and it's imprecise, so why would you want to do that? If you go on the C side, field-based is not an option because it's unsound. And your choices are between field-insensitive and field-sensitive. And field-sensitive seems to be a better choice because you don't get too much speed gain with a field-insensitive. Probably the main reason that people would do a field-insensitive analysis is ease of implementation and, you know, a better feeling about the soundness, right? There's fewer crazy C programs that violate the standard, but that are still out there that will make that will give you an unsound result with a field insensitive analysis. Okay, more questions about.
I missed the part of the
The unsoundness of...
Okay, so the high-level intuition is that in C, you're not guaranteed that if you write to a field F that you can only read that value out of field F.
Oh, I see. Yeah, okay.
Right? And depending on... Yeah, so, but even if you interpret the... So the standard actually gives very strict rules about how reading and writing to fields happens. But even with the strictest interpretation of the standard, you can still find examples. You know, they're not as trivial to find, but there are still examples where a field-based analysis will go wrong.
It's not happening for field sensitive because you separate the objects.
Right.
And they, so the problem is if you continue, if you separate the fields but don't separate the objects, then you do have the fields that will be the same memory location.
Sure.
If you do that. Okay, but
how can you handle the arbitrary casts in C? So if you're just casting to the character or whatever.
So
let's see. So okay, so I you know, I've done more with Java than C. If you cast to, okay, so the standard does give you lots of rules that help you to make this, you know, to make this sound. But if you cast to a character array, so you then need to cast back, right? And if you take you can't read a field out of a character array. You can read a character, right? You can read a byte, but you can't, read something out and interpret it as a pointer unless you, reassemble it into a pointer, right? If you then cast another a pointer to a character array and copy the characters over, but once you're doing that kind of thing, your analysis would have to notice that you're basically just writing random bytes into your second pointer, and it would have to make a conservative assumption that it would point to everything. As far as casting, the standard does actually, give you a lot of rules. You can't just kind of cast a struct to a completely different, or a pointer to a struct to a completely different, a pointer to a completely different struct and expect to have it just work according to the standard. But, there are cases like unions where, you do expect some things to work. But even there, so I guess the point with C is you have to look at the standard very carefully and make sure you cover the things where the standard doesn't give you guarantees. Then you have to invent some extra rules to add onto the standard to cover, all the real-world programs that you expect to see that violate the standard, and then you hope that you don't get something that violates it even more. Or you can try to detect things that violate it even more. Obviously, a program that takes an integer, casts it to a pointer, and dereferences that, your analysis should see that and say, okay, forget it, right? There's nothing you can do there. But such a program, it also violates the standard, right? If you do that, the compiler is allowed to generate whatever code it wants, right? It could, generate code to wipe your hard drive. It's perfectly legal. But anyway. Okay, so C gets very hairy, as I'm sure you can imagine. But at least if you have a field insensitive or a field sensitive analysis, you have a chance of making it reasonably sound. Which doesn't. Well, anyway. Okay, so comparison with zero CFA. Basically, what we've done is we got rid of the yellow nodes, so now we just end up having a points 2 set for each green node, and if you wave your hands a little bit and call the green nodes var, this is what the output of your analysis is, And it looks just like zero CFA, except for that call there. And that was just because of flow sensitivity. And you can do a flow insensitive CFA, zero CFA. So now you have exactly zero CFA, a flow insensitive zero CFA. And hopefully Matt agrees with that.
I agree.
Great. Uh-oh. You disagree?
That's a good point.
Well, maybe there's a difference then.
Sorry?
Well, certainly the state spaces match up more nicely here, so. Okay.
Yeah, so I actually wonder if we could do zero CFA in.
Okay, so let's talk about that.
Yeah.
Flow insensitive.
Yeah, flow insensitive.
Yeah, okay, so let's talk about that afterwards. Okay, so another design decision that I tend not to make very much in the kinds of analyses that I do, but it's a nice and simple one to go through before we get into the more hairy ones, is directionality. And okay, so what we've been doing so far is a subset-based analysis. It goes by lots of different names. Some people call this an inclusion-based analysis. Some people call this Anderson's analysis. Now, I haven't actually talked to Anderson, but I've talked to a lot of people who say that this is a misleading name, because the analysis that Anderson actually had in his thesis in many ways looks nothing like any analysis that people usually call Anderson's analysis. So, you know, it differs in just about everything except for the fact that it was a subset-based analysis. But anyway, you'll hear lots of people call any subset-based analysis Anderson's analysis, even if it's totally different. Okay, so what does this mean? Well, what it means is that each of these flow edges introduces a subset constraint on the points two sets. Okay, so you know, whenever I have one of these edges, it means that at the beginning of the edge, the points two set I have there has to be a subset of what I've got at the end of the edge. Okay, so and to solve those constraints, you do the flow like we've been doing. Now, if you look at the pointer assignment graph, it's always sound to add extra edges, right? You know, so I could add an edge from here to here, and my points two sets would only increase, right? So I'm always free to add extra edges. Yes, my precision will go down, but I'm still going to be sound. I'm never going to get smaller sets if I just add edges. All right? So one thing I could do is that every time I have an edge going from x to z, let's say, I could add the opposite edge going from z to x. Right? So every time I have an edge, I make it bidirectional. I make another edge going in the opposite direction. Okay, so here we go. Now you might be wondering, okay, why would you want to do that? We'll get to that. But it's sound. I can make these edges go both ways. It's less precise. You know, now I have all of my pointers pointing to both L1 and L2. It's less precise, but it's still sound. So one. Unification-based analysis, Steensgaard's analysis. I have talked to Steensgaard. And, you know, he thinks the naming is completely ridiculous. But, you know, he actually has an analysis that he designed that is actually what people use and call it a Steensgaard's analysis. So at least. We call it an equality-based analysis because by having the subset constraints go in both directions, we've now forced these nodes to have the same points two sets. Right? You know, anything that's in here has to be in here. Anything that's in here has to be in here. Okay, so, you know, why do we do this? Well, we do this because we can implement this more efficiently than by propagating sets around. Right? So because we have the property that we have these equality constraints, well, you know, rather than propagating things from set to set, we can just say these nodes are going to have the same set, and so we're just going to merge the nodes together and have a single set for the nodes. Okay, so first step is we would propagate all the allocation edges, get our L1 and L2 into X and Y. Then anytime we have an edge, an assignment edge, we merge those nodes together. And so now we just have this one monster node, and we know that it points to L1 and L2. But if you really want to keep the efficiency of the algorithm, you need to do one more thing. You know, if you look at this, yeah, you merge the nodes, but now you've still got this points to set of this L1, L2. You know, how do you represent that? Right? If in merging the nodes you have to union the sets together, you're not going to be as efficient as you could be. So the extra step that we do is that any time we merge some nodes together, we also merge the nodes that they point to. Okay? So we keep an invariant that for every green node at any point in time, it can only point to a single blue node. Okay? So any node can only point to one other thing. And if you get a case where you'd be merging nodes and you'd have them point to multiple different things, you merge all the things that they point to as well, so that you know, for any node, you only need to keep one pointer to some other node. Okay, so we merge L1 and L2 together, and now we have that single node that represents all the objects allocated both at L1 and L2. And we know that X or Y or Z could point to those objects. Okay, so, you know, if you implement this with a union find data structure, you get a running time that's basically linear. So, you know, that's very fast. But precision-wise, you know, maybe not that great. Okay, so I have another example that's from C, mainly to illustrate this merging of the pointed two nodes again, just to make sure that it makes sense. Because it's, anyway, it can be a bit tricky to see. So it's also illustrating these address of nodes if we're taking addresses of variables. You could do this same or an analogous example in Java, but the you know, you wouldn't be able to take the addresses of things, so you'd end up with a much more complicated program. So that's why I'm showing you this in C. So if you have these four statements, here's the graph that you get from them. And people that are working only on C points to analysis, you know, they tend to use a single node to represent both the pointer B and its points to set, and this address of B. You know, they'll draw it as a single node, and they'll have edges going in and out of it. I like to keep them separate, mainly to be clear on what it is that you're pointing to and what it is that is doing the pointing, right? So the green nodes are things that point to things, and the blue nodes are things that are pointed to. And that makes things less confusing when you add in dynamically allocated objects. All right, so if we were to do a subset-based analysis, this is what we'd get at the end of it. These light blue nodes behave just like the dark blue nodes we had before. And so we have that B points to the C and that D points to E. All right, now if we do an equality-based analysis one step at a time, so the first step is we propagate the, I'm processing each statement at a time. So if you say A equals address of B, well, we'll propagate the address of B node into the points to set of A. B gets the address of C, so you propagate that. And now if I propagate the address of D into A, I need to merge those nodes, the address of B and the address of D node. At the same time, I merge the B and the D nodes. And so now my analysis thinks that B could point to C, but it also thinks that D could point to C, which is imprecise, but you know that's what you pay to do an efficient analysis. And then finally, I propagate E into D. And once I do that, I also have to merge C and E. Okay, so now, you know, if C and E were pointing to things, I wouldn't be able to distinguish C and E and the different things that they point to. Okay, so it's a very, very efficient analysis if you don't need too much precision. And one other nice thing about an equality-based analysis is that it partitions the set objects that you can point to, you know, into these partitions, right? So you know, if your application is something that needs to group objects together, you know, this is often a good analysis. So an example of that is the work of Chris Lattner and Vikram Advay. I don't know if anyone here's familiar with that. They had a bunch of PLDI papers on it. So they were partitioning objects that are used together and allocating them together in order to improve cache efficiency. And they got some very good results with an equality-based analysis. There's a problem when you get to object-oriented programs in general. So let's see an object-oriented program. So here's a Java program, and you've got class A, and class A has a constructor that calls the superclass constructor, the constructor on object. And even if you don't write this constructor, Java C will put it in for you automatically. So you can't not have this constructor. Whenever you create an object, you must call all the constructors all the way up the hierarchy, and you must eventually call the constructor of object. All right. So, you know, if you have these constructor calls and you draw the pointer assignment graph for that, you get this. So basically, from allocation site L1, your object flows to this pointer of the A constructor, and from there it flows to this pointer of the object constructor. And then once the constructors are done, you get L1 into your variable X, like you asked. All right, if you have L2, you get the same thing, and you'll notice that all the allocation sites flow to the object constructor. All right, so if you do a equality-based analysis, this is a disaster, right? Because now, because all the edges are bidirectional, all the objects flow into this of the object constructor. So you end up merging L1 and L2. And now, you know, if you do this, you end up with a very unuseful fact, you know, every pointer could point to every object, right? Because all your objects were merged together into a single node, and all your pointers get merged together into a single node, and, you know, everything points to everything. So, you know, you can do some tricks like ignoring the object constructor and, you know, doing subset-based when it comes to constructors, but equality-based everywhere else. But, you know, unless you do something strange, you're going to get very imprecise results here. Now, one thing you can do that actually saves you from all of this is to use context sensitivity. So we're going to talk about context sensitivity later. But you pretty much need context sensitivity to save an equality-based analysis. And the work that Lattner and Advay did, they weren't using an object-oriented language. I'm trying to remember whether they did any C++ or only C. But in any case, they were not doing Java, but they still used a context-sensitive analysis to get around a lot of the imprecision of equality-based analysis. Okay, so we'll see how context sensitivity fixes this later. So questions there? Okay, so before we get to context sensitivity, we need to talk about call graph construction. So many people already know what a call graph is. Just to be clear, a call graph is what tells you whenever you have a call in the program, what are all the possible functions that it could call. Okay, and as we saw at the very beginning, for C, that's usually very easy. You just look at the name of the function that you're calling. For object-oriented or for functional languages, there could be lots of possible targets depending on the type of the object that you're making the call on. Okay, so before we talk about how we build the call graph, here's a question for you. So here's a Java program. You know, is this a small Java program or a big Java program? Okay, anyway, so we'll answer that in a moment. So if I run this program and I look inside the VM and I, you know, try to count how many distinct methods get executed when I run this code, any guesses on how many methods will get executed? So we've got 30, 4, 200. Okay, so to answer my first question, this is a big Java program because there are no small Java programs. Every Java program is big. So if I run this program and I count the methods executed in the VM, I get 498. This is with Java 1.3. If you do it with Java 1.6, you'll probably get more than that, but I haven't tried that. Okay, so this is, you know, what actually gets executed. Now, part of that is, the library methods. You go into print line and it has to, format the bytes of the string and call all sorts of other stuff. But you also get VM internal things happening, you know, things like the class loader, initializers for, VM data structures, things like that. You know, trivial program like this, you get 500 methods that are actually executed. So if we want our call graph to be sound, you know, it better be at least 500 methods, right? You know, it's got to contain all the ones that actually, or 498, I guess, is safe. All right, so if we do, if we try to come up with a very precise static call graph, you know, using a precise points to analysis, so let's say the one we looked at the very beginning, field-sensitive, subset-based. You know, what size call graph are we going to get? Well, okay. We get a call graph with about 3,200 methods in it. Okay, and I've actually spent quite a bit of time looking at this call graph, looking for ways to get this number down, because obviously it's a lot less precise than what actually happens at runtime. And I haven't yet found, you know, good ways to get precision down more than this. Certainly you can do imprecise analyses that will give you a much larger call graph. You know, so the Java standard library has tens of thousands of methods, and you can get call graphs that have tens of thousands of methods if you're not careful to build a very precise one. But, you know, once you have your call graph, this is where you do all of your subsequent analysis, whether it's pointer analysis or other analyses on top of it. So it would be really nice to have precise static call graphs. Some of the reason why it's so big is that there are things in the library that you could actually think of crazy scenarios where they would execute. Okay, so a lot of this are things that you can't exclude from the call graph because, you know, it is possible for them to execute, so you can't prove that they're not going to. You know, another big reason why this is so big is just imprecision in the analysis. You know, Java, even though the dynamic language people think of it as a very static language, because of dynamic dispatch, you know, it actually is very hard to prove that, you know, there's no path into through a library to some method. Okay, so we want precise call graphs, but, you know, we need to get them in reasonable time, and there are some limits on how precise we can get them, even if we do very precise analyses.
So when you say there are things that could possibly under some criticism,
yes. Those things exist, but they're not, I mean, the things you mentioned are not the causes of the big blow-up. The one big one that I remember is if you take this program and you take the class file, you put it in a jar file, you know, lots of people do that. If the jar file is signed, so you can sign the jar file, if the jar file is signed, when the VM sees it, it's going to try to verify the signature. And to do that, it's going to load and run all sorts of crypto code, and you get a lot of methods out of that. The other thing that tends to get dragged in are networking methods, because, you know, you could be running in an applet and the classes could be coming in over the network. So that's another big source of imprecision. But then there are also sources of imprecision in the sense that, you know, when you do your print line, well, you know, here you're printing to the screen, but, you know, there's code to write to files and there's code to write to the network, and it's very hard to be, I mean, so if we didn't have the class loading stuff, then you could say, well, this program doesn't do that, so you wouldn't have the networking code and the file code in the graph, but because parts of the VM do call that code, it does end up getting tangled up with the code of the program. Okay, so we want to build precise call graphs. So how do we get precise call graphs? Well, you know, to know what you call, you need to know the points to set. So you need to do a pointer analysis before you can build your call graph. But yeah, so can you do a pointer analysis with a call graph? Well, okay, so let's try to fill in this chart. So to compute the points two sets, you know, what do you need to compute the points two sets? Okay, so this is not a trick question. We've been doing this all along. Well, okay, so the way we compute points two sets is we build the pointer assignment graph and we propagate points two sets along it. So to get the points two sets, you need the pointer assignment graph, you know, the thing with the colored nodes. To get that, well, okay, so where do the edges in that graph come from? Well, they come from flow of pointers in the program, so from assignments in the program. Oh, you had a,
no.
You were going to answer.
No.
No, you weren't. Okay. Okay, and so, you know, how do we know what all the assignments in the program are? Okay, I should be like David and just, you know, stop if the room is silent. So. Okay, I kind of gave it away there, right? So, you know, if you know that some method might execute, well, you look through it and look at all the assignments, and for each assignment, you get an edge. Okay, so to get the pointer assignment edges, you need to know which methods are reachable. Right? Anything else? Okay, well, I won't stall too long. So you also need the call graph edges, right? So if I have a method call, I need to make a pointer assignment edge from the arguments to the parameters and another one coming back for the return value. Okay, so in order to add those pointer assignment edges, I need all the call graph edges. Well, okay. So what do I need to get the reachable methods? Well, I can start at the main method, and I can follow the call graph edges to, to find a transitive closure, to find all the methods that you can reach from the beginning, from the main method. All right, and to compute the call graph edges, well, what I need are the points two sets. Right, because at a call, to know what I call, I need to know what the receiver points to. Okay, so if you put these in a graph, a dependence graph, there you go. And you'll notice, well, what will you notice? It's not a DAG, right? So it's a cycle. So, you know, what comes first, the chicken or the egg? All right, so everything depends on everything else. So there's different things we can do, right? So one thing we can do is start off with some imprecise information and then go around and eventually we'll get something more precise. And so a simple solution is to do ahead of time call graph construction. So here, what I mean by ahead of time is that we're building the call graph before we do the pointer analysis. Okay, but you know, so to build the call graph, we need pointer information. But since we're doing it before the pointer analysis, we can just make a completely conservative assumption and basically assume that any pointer could point anywhere. Right? We can be a little bit more precise than that, and at least use the types of the pointers and say that any pointer can point to any object that's compatible with its type. Then we use that assumption to build the call graph edges and find the transitive closure of those edges to get our reachable methods. Okay, so this is called class hierarchy analysis. Basically, we're building the call graph assuming that any pointer could point to any object that has a compatible type. So very imprecise assumptions about what the objects could point to. And this allows us to build a call graph without any points two sets. Okay, so at that point here, we've got our call graph. So now we can do you know, what we've been doing all along, which is take the call graph, build the pointer assignment edges, and propagate the points two sets. And now we're done our points two analysis. If our goal is to have a precise call graph, we could at this point redo the call graph construction, right? So we could throw away the reachable methods and the call graph edges that we've already computed and recompute them again with this information. So we'll have a more precise call graph for future analyses. Okay. So any questions on this? You could actually do that again and again, right? So you could do this again and again, with the caveat that you are starting with a fairly imprecise call graph. So in theory, and actually in practice as well, you are never going to get a call graph that's as precise as if you were to skip ahead two slides and do the other thing. So, okay, but it's true that you can iterate and your call graph will get more and more precise each time. You know, eventually you'll hit a fixed point, but that fixed point will not necessarily be as precise as it could be if you had done the next thing. Okay, but yeah.
You added a call graph with nodes for a small program in Java.
Yes.
How scalable is your approach with this kind of big call graph? For future answers, how scalable can it be?
So, how scalable are the other analyses that you do on top of this? Well, so it depends on the analysis. For the pointer analysis, it's no problem scaling to 3,000 methods like we had, or even the tens of thousands of methods. If you then go build other analyses on it, well, you know, you need to expect to have fairly large call graphs. I don't have exact numbers for the call graph that you get with this technique, where you start with the fully imprecise one, but, you know, they can be around twice the size of the precise one. Okay, so summarizing this, the nice thing is that you have no iteration, or you don't have to have any iteration. Right, you just do each piece once, but you get very imprecise results because a lot of methods end up being reachable right from the very beginning. Because you're assuming that any call could go to any object of any of the types that's compatible with the pointer, you're going to hit code that has nothing to do with what your program is actually doing. Right? If there's a class in the library that has a compatible type, well, you're going to assume that you might be calling that class. Okay. Okay, so a more precise thing is to, you know, just do the iteration as it appears. Okay? So the idea is we'd start at the bottom. We'd start with an empty call graph, an empty points two set, empty everything. And we'd build things up, and as we add each thing, we would follow the dependencies and add the corresponding other things. Okay? So I guess the main method would start out as being reachable. We'd look at the main method. We'd see what calls are in there. We'd see what pointer assignments are in there. Add those to the call graph edges and to the pointer assignment graph, then we'd propagate along those edges, get some points, two sets, and we'd keep repeating this until we reach a fixed point. Okay, so this is going to give us the most precise information that we can get, okay, because we didn't start with any imprecision at the beginning. But, I mean, it has some drawbacks. The main one is it requires iteration, and so it's going to be slower. Okay, you know, if you go back to the field-based algorithm, you know, there, because you had the full pointer assignment graph, you could do a field-based analysis very quickly because you only had to process each node once. When you're adding pointer assignment edges to the graph as you go, you end up needing to reprocess a lot of nodes. Okay? So here, even if you're doing a field-based analysis, you're not going to have your whole pointer assignment graph at the beginning. So as you iterate, you know, you are going to end up having to repropagate things. And, you know, that goes not just for the pointer analysis. You know, as you iterate and add call edges, you're going to add methods. As you add reachable methods, you're going to add new call edges. And, you know, everything is going to have to get built up incrementally. So it can be quite a bit slower. It's a lot more complicated to implement and a lot harder to get right. You know, it's very easy to miss one of these dependencies. Basically, what you need are work lists for all of these components, and you have to make sure that when something changes that affects one of the components, that it's for sure added to the right work list. Implementation gets a lot more complicated. But, you know, the payoff is that you get a much more precise call graph, which is really nice for points to analysis and for any analysis that you then do on top of this. Okay, so for many analyses, it is worth the pain of building a call graph as precise as you can get it. You know, because in many cases, this will give you a call graph that's half the size of what you'd get with a less precise analysis. So, okay. Now, I just want to mention one other technique that is that you do sometimes see in papers. And so I call this a partly on-the-fly call graph construction because it's kind of a hybrid of both techniques. And so we start out by assuming that all the methods are reachable. Then we go and generate pointer assignment edges for those methods, but we don't generate any edges for method calls. Okay, so we don't do anything for parameter passing or return values. We do the points to set propagation, and then we iterate, we add edges, we add call graph edges based on the points to sets, and then based on those call graph edges, we add the pointer assignment edges. Okay, so people do this. It's not a completely bad idea, but it's not that good an idea. So you end up still requiring iteration, right? So you still have this cycle in the dependencies, so you still have to iterate there. You end up iterating a lot less, and in terms of implementation complexity, it's not that bad because you're only iterating these three things and not, you know, all four of them. Okay. In terms of precision, it gives you precision somewhere in between the two approaches. You know, you do lose precision by assuming that all methods are reachable at the beginning, but, you know, if the methods are reachable but you have no parameters going in and out of them, they tend not to affect the rest of the points to sets very much, right? Because you have no points to sets flowing in and out of them. The only place where those extra reachable methods actually make a difference is if you have loads and stores to global variables, like static fields. Unfortunately, you do get some leakage of imprecision through those static fields. So it's you know, not a huge loss in precision, but there is a loss in precision there. Okay, so it's kind of an in-between solution. You still get a lot of the complexity of an on-the-fly call graph, not all of the precision. It's not a very good compromise, but it is one that people sometimes do. And so I just want you to be aware of it so that if you're reading a paper, you can notice when this happens. Okay, how long was I supposed to have till, do I have 5 minutes or 15 minutes?
If you want to go for more than five, you're welcome.
So the normal time was five?
10:20.
Would be 10:20?
Yes.
Okay. Okay, so context sensitivity is a big topic, or a long topic. What I'm going to do is take 5 minutes to just, you know, show you the first slide, get you thinking about why we would want context sensitivity, and then I'll stop and we'll leave context sensitivity till tomorrow. Okay, so here's the slide. You might notice some similarity with Matt's slide on context sensitivity. So we have two objects that we create, A and B, and we know that they're separate, distinct objects because they're allocated at different places. And if we were to just say C equals A and D equals B, our points to analysis would be able to keep those objects separate, right? It would say that C points to L1 and D points to L2, and those are two distinct objects, so it knows that they're different. Well, you know, the moment we throw in an identity method and we make the assignment go through this identity method that just returns its argument, what happens is the analysis loses that information. And the reason is that we end up with an assignment from A to the variable O in the identity method and from B to that same variable. And that variable is abstracted by this single green node, and so everything flows together into that green node, and then it gets returned, and then the return takes that points to set to both C and D. Okay? So what we'd like is some way of keeping those two objects distinct and getting only L1 into C and L2 into D. All right, so you know you can be thinking, and you can use your intuition to extrapolate from Matt's stuff of ways that we could regain this precision. I just want to say one more thing about this example. So you might think that this is a really silly example. Okay, you know, who writes identity methods in their program? Well, okay, so functional programmers seem to do it more often than Java programmers. No, I mean, okay, so yeah, fine. I made up this example for the sake of an example. But the thing is, if you look at real Java programs, they have lots of other complexity, right? They'll have other parameters getting passed into the method. They'll have this object O, you know, being stored somewhere, loaded back out, you know, it goes into different variables, there's some control flow, you get these complicated methods. But, you know, in the end, once you strip away all of that complexity, you know, this kind of a pattern where an object goes in, stuff happens, and then the object gets returned, it actually happens quite a lot. Okay, so you know, the example is unrealistic, but it's only unrealistic because code that's been grossly simplified. You know, I ripped out a lot of other stuff. This kind of pattern does happen all the time. So, okay, so it's not an unrealistic example. Okay, so you can be thinking about all the different ways that we could regain this precision, and there's quite a lot of them. Are there questions on anything we've seen this morning? Yeah.
Conclusion, because like you said, those three possible things.
So on construction,
the conclusion. Okay, so the brief conclusion is, you really want the precision. You want a fully ahead of time call graph construction because it affects all your analyses that come later on. If you're not willing to pay the time and the implementation cost of the full precision, then you might as well do the ahead of time call graph construction, which is a lot simpler. It's faster. If you do this, and for your points to analysis, you use a field-based analysis, it can be very efficient. So you'll get an okay call graph with not much effort. So I think those are your two choices. Right. So do you want a call graph that's as precise as you can get it, or do you want a call graph that you can build as fast as you can read in the files and not have to do too much implementation to get it? That's basically your choices. Yeah?
People that have to deal with this graph of the whole library system in order to analyze Hello World, maybe there's no way out of that, but I'm wondering, are there principled ways to take big subsystem and somehow simplify down the graph that you really need to have to do analysis of other things?
So that's a really good question, and I think that's a really cool area of research. It's an area that I've been trying to encourage students to look at, and they tend not to want to for some reason. But it's definitely an area that's very relevant, and that I'd be very interested in getting into. There's not a whole lot in terms of solutions. So there have been attempts to try to summarize libraries and get, some sort of graph that summarizes what the library does. The other thing that hasn't been tried that much that has some chance of working is making conservative assumptions. Just assume the library can do anything. But the trick there is you have to be very careful about how you define what can do anything actually means. If you're not careful, not analyzing the library can completely blow your precision on the rest of the program. So I think the challenge there is to find a good definition of what the library can and can't do, what libraries tend to do, and to experimentally verify what happens if you make those assumptions. There's a common belief that if you don't analyze the library, that you're going to get really imprecise results. And I'm not sure that that's actually true if you make the right assumptions. But that is something that, needs to be done and needs to be checked. Yeah?
So you mentioned comparing the call graph to the effectiveness of voice analysis. Does it really evaluate it? What other ways would you evaluate it?
Okay, so I'm not sure I totally understand the question, but I had a slide way back, and it was not about call graphs, it was about points to sets. And I said that, if you run the program once and you look at what the points to sets are, That's a lower bound on what the real points two sets on all possible executions is, right? On the other hand, your static analysis is an upper bound on what the points two set on all possible executions is. In general, that precise result of, you know, what is the real points two set, that's uncomputable. But, you know, these the dynamic one and the static one give you bounds on that result. So, you know, if we can get those closer together, then we have a better sense of where the real call graph is, because we know it's somewhere in between there. I don't know if that is what you were asking about.
But okay, I guess my question is, you can only really evaluate points two in terms of a client for the analysis.
Okay.
And how useful it is. And one client is making the call graph.
Mm-hmm.
And how, you know, imprecise is the call graph.
Okay.
And are there other, that's one way of looking how precise it is. Are there other ways of looking how precise the analysis is in terms of how people would actually use it?
So what other things people would use the pointer analysis for?
And that would be useful for trying to say, oh, this approach is better than this approach.
You mean, what do you mean by this approach? So this approach to pointer analysis? Or
precise and imprecise, right?
But, right.
Those are kind of abstract.
So precision is an abstract notion in the sense that, you know, for some application, a large points two set might not make any difference, right? If your application is building call graphs, then looking at how good the call graphs are, you know, that's a more relevant measure of how good your pointer analysis was. So, you know, if your application is parallelization, then, you know, a good measure of how good your pointer analysis is for parallelization is how much stuff you manage to parallelize. But I think I'm just repeating what you said rather than answering the question.
You're just saying the actual point it's going to use it for, there's no
and look at,
way of looking at it.
Right, so look at how...
Maybe what you're asking is there a way to look at the points two sets and predict from those how well they're going to work for a specific client? I'm not aware of any way to do that. I think you pretty much have to, you know, plug in your client and see how it does with the pointer information that it gets. Just because, you know, there's so many different possible clients and they all use the information in so many different ways. So, okay, so thank you. So we'll do the end of this tomorrow. So...